Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Josh Green. We'll talk to Josh about 2023, the year in wine, through the lens of wines Josh has selected. We'll be tasting wines throughout the show, which will be our weekly wine sip on steroids in a way. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Josh Green is the longtime editor, publisher, and owner of Wine and Spirits magazine. Josh also serves as its critic for Napa Valley, Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Portugal, Rioja, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. He has also traveled extensively, and after this show, he's on his way to Vienna. He's traveled extensively to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Portugal, Italy, Spain, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, and throughout the U.S. You can also find feature stories and commentary by Josh in each issue. Josh Green is always generous with his time and is appearing for the seventh year on The Grape Nation for our 2023 The Year in Wine. Josh, no one else has ever been on The Grape Nation seven times.
Awesome. It's great to be here, Sam.
Not even Pascaline LePeltier.
Well,
who?
I'm honored.
I'm always happy to have you here, and I look forward to this show and as much in planning it and talking about it as the actual show. So I mentioned in the intro, this is our seventh year of Josh and I doing this. I started the show, I think, in 2016 in September, and I met Josh through Laura Catena at a Catena wine tasting. Laura introduced me to Josh, and, you know, I just started the podcast, and on a whim, I said, Josh, I'm doing this podcast. You know, would you come on? And he was able to come on in December. And based on what he does, you know, here's a perfect guy to talk about wine and then even look back at the year. So it's been a great thing.
I really enjoy it, Sam. So I'm really happy to be
here. Yeah. So what we're doing is, you know, we started doing this, you know, Josh would come on and we'd talk urine and subjects. But in the past few years, and this was at Josh's prompting, he said, let me bring in some wines that I think have stories and relate to what's been going on that year or in wine. So we've been doing this by him selecting wines and discussing the wines, the makers, the regions, and the stories behind them. So for me, and I was telling this to Josh off air, it's an unusual show for me because generally I'll select the guest, I'll select all the questions, I'll lead through them. Today, you know, I selected Josh, but Josh selected all the wines. Josh will lead the discussion, and we will taste the wines as we do that. So that's the setup. Before we taste the wines, are there any storylines or anything from the past year of significance, you know, that got a proper amount of ink or was written about over and over?
Well, I feel like the storyline for this year and for the last few years has been climate change and vineyards. And that's what we've been covering so much of. And like our latest issue has three stories about effects of climate change and how people are battling climate change in vineyards. So that seems to be the ongoing challenge, is to find ways of making wine sustainable, as, you know, in places where it's been sustained for centuries.
Right.
Now it's being threatened. So
I knew you were going to say that, and it makes total sense. If you've been covering that for years, I guess evolution is a bad thing with climate change, but how has the coverage changed? Is it everywhere now, or it always was everywhere and you need to talk about it everywhere? Are people more specific in, you know, what they're doing?
Our coverage has been more based on our observation of what's going on and what interests us and what we think are interesting solutions that people have had. Corey Warren, who is our tastings editor, he went over to Chablis this summer, and it was super hot there, and yet they were having trouble with frost in the spring.
That's crazy.
So he did some research with the Moors, who have a vineyard in Vaudevet, the Premier Cru Vaudevet, that they had done some planting, replanting of a portion of the vineyard with trellis, with high trellis, like a pergola, to keep the buds away from the cold air that descends in a frost. You know, the most dangerous place in frost time is close to the ground. So they created this pergola system, and they're beginning to see good results from it. And it's one of the ways that people are dealing with, you know, replanting their vineyards in a way that will be sustainable in the 10 years or 20 years to come. Who knows what's after that?
Right.
But that they can continue to make great wine in the place where they've been making great wine before.
Is that pergola system typical height, or is it higher? Because a lot of winemakers are going vertical, you know, mm-hmm. they're going higher.
Yeah, this is higher than vines than normally would
normally
be.
Would.
But it's not higher than pergolas normally would be. I mean, if you go to Rías Baixas, where they grow a lot of Albariño, a lot of the 100-year and 150-year-old vines are in pergolas. And they're very tall. You have to get up on a ladder to pick them. And
that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a way to manage vineyards in a different kind of climate than people are used to.
I had Jean-Baptiste Le Callion only a few weeks ago on, mm-hmm. and he's talking about more
for Roederer, he's gonna do
more vertical, mm-hmm. you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he started doing that, and
he's a really brilliant grower, so it'll be interesting to see what
he's very much in tune and touch to the land and the cellar and all that. I give him that for all the innovation. Anything besides climate change, and I don't diminish by saying besides. I mean, I
think that because we are focused on vineyards, that's been the story that we can't escape. There, you know, there's certainly a lot of continuing consolidation. I think that if you look at the consolidation, a lot of it's being driven by climate change. You know, people like Larry Stone having to sell his vineyard because he didn't get a crop one year because of the climate. And so it went to Constellation. So a big company buys a little tiny company. And there's a lot of that going on.
So that's interesting, because that's a good example. So Larry, in a sense, was forced to make a decision for survival based on the crap nature threw at him.
Yeah.
You know, by that the only way I want to survive and could survive is to either, you know, sell or consolidate with somebody.
It's a very financially intensive business, because you have lots of stock. So if you get really bashed by a vintage and you don't have any wine to sell, you're screwed. If you're a small producer, you're completely screwed. And it's not something that used to happen often. Now it's happening more often.
Yeah. I spoke to Dan Petroski from Massacon, mm-hmm. which he's really taking on his own project.
Yes.
And it's really him and maybe a couple of helpers. And he's so close to what you're talking about. I mean, he knows how much output he has. He knows where he's getting his wine. Any change in that, you know, could screw everything up. And it's a tough situation.
There's not a lot of breathing room, especially, you know, the pandemic came along and really messed up small business. So there's not a lot of breathing room for people.
Yeah. Hopefully, as we come out of it, we'll figure out how to deal with climate change and it'll help these guys. All right, so let's get into the wines.
Sure.
We have four wines in front of us and we're going to taste and discuss each wine and, you know, the reason Josh picked these, the story behind them. Just to set up and then we'll get more specific. We have a wine from the Itata region of Chile, a país. Interesting area. I'm excited to hear Josh talk about it. We have two wines from the Alentejo region of Portugal, which when people think of Portugal, they're not thinking as much Alentejo as they should. And we're going to talk about that. Both Josh and I are huge Portugal wine fans. So that'll be great. And this will be interesting to you. And then he found an interesting project in Sonoma. The varietal and, you know, what they're doing. So we'll talk about that. All right, so let's get started. So, Josh, the first wine we're going to taste and talk about is the Ana Maria Cumcie.
Yes. It's a país from Itata.
2021 Itata Aguia País. Just a little background. You gave this wine 94 points. It's about $30. Let's talk about Itata in Chile. People know they've drank wines from Chile. Itata may not be on everyone's tip.
People don't know about it for any number of reasons. One is that País is Mission, is similar to Mission or the same grape as Mission. And in Mission in California does not tend to produce any great wines. It happens to produce great wines in Chile, but it was used as a bulk up a lot of the wines that were like from Bordeaux varieties in the Central Valley and in the Alto Maipo for years. So it was always considered what people drank. You know, it was the peasant wine that people drank. And I've just completely come to love these wines. I've started going down there maybe 10 years ago now to Itata. And at the time, very few journalists outside of Chile were going down there at all. It was considered pretty much trash wine, but there were growers who had discovered it. There were winemakers, and especially Louis-Antoine Louis, a Frenchman, had discovered this area and was really promoting it. So it's a very beautiful rolling hill, you know, rolling hills, a lot of granite, a lot of volcanic soils. They have something called Trumau, which is this kind of light, airy, puffy volcanic soil. And when the Jesuits came when the conquistadors came and they brought priests over, the priests brought vines with them, and people think that it might be related to some vineyards in the Canary Islands, because that's where people would stop off on their way. But these wines were ignored. And so because the vineyards were ignored, they're really, really ancient. So this wine is from, they say, vineyards planted in around 1800. And a lot of, when you go to these vineyards, a lot of them, the root systems are 200 years old or older. And it's fascinating to see this kind of viticulture because it's just this bed of vines. You know, it's not really farmed in any specific way.
Does it almost look like bushes?
They almost look like bushes, but they're more random than bushes,
right?
Because they're coming out of the ground all over the place. And you know, there's a wine called País Salvaje that Bouchon makes in Maule, which is a little bit further north, that they grow on the forest edge at the edge of the vineyard. and the vines grow up into the hill, into the trees, and they pick them from the tree. They pick the grapes from the trees, and it's beautiful wine. So this wine, I'm still tasting it. I tasted it when I opened it to pour it to see if it was corked, and it's not corked at all. This wine just has the longest fragrant character that you. I love this wine. It's delicate. People who enjoy Pinot Noir, I think, would fall in love with these wines because structurally they are sort of somewhere between Pinot Noir and Nebbiolo. They have the tannins are a little bit harder, but not aggressive, and the fruit is very red and very pretty, and it's very fragrant. So
so color wise, similar
it's
to
transparent, yeah,
Barolo and Pinot, maybe mm-hmm. a teeny bit more transparent.
Mm-hmm.
Mouthfeel is similar.
Mm-hmm.
It's not lighter or heavier. It's got a similar, you know, mouthfeel. On the nose, you're getting mostly red fruits.
Red fruits and flowers.
Flowers, right.
I mean, for me, it's not a kind of aggressive floral character, but it's a grape. You know, grape skins have a lot of floral character to them, and they create esters as they ferment. And this has a lot of that kind of estery floral character to it.
It's pretty well integrated too.
I think it's beautifully integrated. Yeah.
So she just
took a job actually at Carmen in the Alto Maipo and Alto Jajuel. Carmen's part of the Santa Rita group, and she's now their chief winemaker up there. But she's also continuing this project, and she has about four or five growers that she works with, and she makes the wine at Laberinto, which is. Rafael Tirado's place in, I guess it's in the hills above above Maule. And she's making really beautiful wines. But there are others. I had wanted to bring some wine by Felipe Ramirez, who is making a wine called Dominio de Quarzo. And that wine, he's from Chile, but he's now making wine at Rosanaro in Oregon. So it makes this very sophisticated Pinot Noir.
You and I tasted Rosanaro last year or the year before.
So that's his wine in Oregon. He's making that wine for that company. But this is his own wine. And it was down visiting him this past year, as well as Pedro Parra.
He's a protege or a friend of Parra, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They have a relationship.
Well, their wineries are next door to each other. They're on the same basically driveway, the same basic driveway. And they are both using these vineyards that are, you know, when you go to a place like this and you see these old vineyards that they've chosen, you know, because Pedro really knows his vineyards well. And Felipe's no slouch. Felipe's really brilliant. And they found what they consider the Grand Cru of this area in Guaralihue.
Right.
And the wines are magnificent. Both the wines that Pedro's making and the wines that Felipe is making, I think, are completely magnificent. And Felipe is making a Censo from one area and a País from another area. And they're both beautiful vineyards.
So quality, we know, is there. Value is...
I think the value is astonishing
for what
you're getting. I'm actually... My friend and I have both decided that we want to buy a couple of cases of these wines just to have, because I mean, I've got tons of wine around. I don't need to buy any wine.
Right.
It's stupid of me to buy wine. I love drinking these wines so much and they're so crazy priced. You know, and I always think about when I was getting into this business and I could buy Rumier for $25 a bottle and I am pissed at myself for not having bought cases of it at the time.
Even a 2000 Mouton Rothschild in the gold bottle.
Yeah.
That was 23 years ago things were, you know, we didn't do it.
But I would have bought that as a collectible. I wouldn't have bought it to drink. I would have bought the Chambol as a wine to drink.
Right.
I would buy these as wine to drink. And they're affordable to me in a way that wines that I love to drink are not.
Are these ageable wines?
I don't know.
But... Fair, and I probably agree with that answer without knowing anything, but there would be no detriment to maybe holding them a year or two and trying them.
No, I think for a year they'll definitely improve.
Yeah.
Whether they'll improve for 20 years, I don't know. That's not what these – I don't think these wines are being made with that intention.
I don't either. It's more of a, you know.
And I think I like them better because they're not being made with that intention.
Do these wines scream for a little chilling or not necessarily? Or that's I a think personal that preference?
If you serve them cellar temperature, it's fine. I don't think they need to be cold.
Right.
I think, in fact, the fragrance, I love the fragrance of these wines. So if you chill them, they're going to be less fragrant.
So Itata has Male and is...
So there's a city down there called Concepcion, which is an incredible place to go for fish. If you love fish...
It's a major city.
It's a major city in Chile. And if you love fish, this is like heaven for you. You can go to restaurants that do sushi that's insanely great. And a lot of it's really inexpensive for the quality of what you're getting.
But chef-driven, like thoughtfully prepared?
You can get very thoughtfully driven. I mean, it's not fancy.
Right.
But very thoughtful. And so Concepcion's on the coast. If you drive straight inland, you get to Itata. If you go a little bit north, you get to Maule.
Okay.
And this is all considered the Secano Interior, which is the dry interior of the coastal mountains.
So my understanding is it's about 60, 70 miles north to south, I read somewhere. Does that sound right?
Or it possibly
seems bigger?
Possibly. It's all, I mean.
Is it the centralish part of the country?
I think that
west?
I think Santiago is considered the center.
Okay.
So everything that you, when you go north of Santiago, you begin to get into desert. You get to Aconcagua first, and then beyond that, you get to La Serena, and you get into desert beyond that, and it's all desert above that. And then below Santiago, you've got the Central Valley down to Maule. That's all considered Central Valley. And below Maule is considered the south.
Got it. And in the areas we talked about, climate, soils, do they vary much or they're pretty much in the Itata region?
They do vary. And you know, if you're close to the coast, you're getting a lot more rain. If you're inland, you're getting much drier, and depends on where you are in relation to the coast and the mountains there. But also, the soils, as I said, there's a lot of granite. I believe there's some schist, but there's also this Trumau, which I think is
that on the top?
It's on the surface, definitely, but it's very deep.
It is.
So, there was a vineyard that I went to, just straight west of Concepcion, that they had rabbit warrens all through their vineyard because the vineyard, the soil was so fluffy, the rabbits just went all the way down, like 6 feet, 7 feet down. Jeez. Into these warrens.
That's interesting. So Itata, Pais, and
Senso
are famous, or prominent there. Mm-hmm. Are they starting to plant other things?
Well, they have other things planted. So Senso came in as a grape to enrich the Pais in the early 20th century. But people, I tasted a Cabernet from Ranquil last week. There was a Chilean event here in the city. And Morande is making a Cabernet from part of Itata. That the vines are, I think, 100 years old.
Wow.
And it was beautiful wine.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm curious to taste it.
And there's also Semillon down there. There's a lot of different varieties down there, but Pais is really, when you look at these ancient vines, that's what you're seeing mostly is Pais.
So that is the Ana Marie Cumcier 2021 Itata Aguilla Pais. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. You know, Josh originally wanted to even do, you know, some comparisons to makers with Pais and Cinzo, Domaine del Quarzo, which you mentioned, mm-hmm. is Felipe Ramirez, and some other wines. All right, so let's move along.
And I would say that I was frustrated in terms of trying to get the wines here.
Yeah, so we talked about that.
I asked about
your intentions were set, and the reality of what you can get is a whole different story.
Yeah, I was going to bring. Basically, I was down in Uruguay this spring, and then went to Chile, and I tried to bring some Uruguay wines. And the three wines I tried to bring from Uruguay, they're not being imported now. They were being imported, now they're not being imported. So supply issues are huge right now, especially for small production wines like this that are. That don't have a lot of distribution. So it's really, I couldn't even get them from the from to my office in time for this. And that usually any of these other wines you can get immediately.
What was interesting to me is when I saw Uruguay, I had traveled to Uruguay. And obviously you drink a lot of Tanat and you go to some really small producers and some of the bigger ones. And some of the bigger ones are like, they're like opus, these wineries. But it was interesting for me to see that you selected an orange wine from Uruguay.
Santiago Decas is making these wines, Bizarro Extravaganza. Bizarro Extravaganza, they've got these crazy labels. He's got an Amphora Tanat, and he's got a orange wine that's, I think, very beautiful. And I'm not a big fan of most orange wines. They're a little too natty for me. But I think that wine is gorgeous, but it's not available in the States anymore.
That stinks.
So it's really, there's these experimental wines from countries that don't have the traction yet. You know, you can get orange wines from Italy very easily because Italian wines have a presence here. They have a restaurant, a body of restaurants that will sell them. But
they also have some prominent makers, Radican and Grosvenor and all those guys.
Yeah. But Decas is a prominent maker in Uruguay.
Yeah.
He's not a small producer, and they've got financing behind them. And I was just disappointed that that wine or their, I tried to get the barrel-less Tanat from another producer, and I couldn't get that. That's not available anymore.
So is the story that they're having trouble getting importers?
No, I think it's a traction issue. I think that it's this market, as I said before, is really more and more dominated by big companies. You know, it's a consolidation issue. And when you have small producers, small artisan producers making wines in a foreign country that doesn't have a lot of presence in this market, it's a lot of work to get those wines distributed. So, you know, wine like this, wine from Ana Maria, it's got a good distributor, but whether you can actually get the wine, because whether they're actually doing anything with it is another question.
Right. So there is distribution. It's a matter of what they're doing with it.
Distribution's really expensive, and it's harder and harder right now.
You know, another interesting thing was I had Isabelle Legeron on from Raw Wine.
Sure.
She has spent a significant amount of time in Chile and in Malé and those areas. And she has a lot of those wineries on board, and they're at the Raw Wine Festivals. And she's been a champion for them. And she understands what you said. I mean, you know, they're at the beginning of trying to, you know, get the visibility they deserve.
They need to be introduced to people.
Yeah.
And I think that there's such a great restaurant opportunity. There's such beautiful wines with food that
I think Somms are getting lazy.
No, I think Somms are into them. I see more Pais on wine lists than I've ever seen before. So it's I think there are a lot of new Somms, and they have a different attitude about their job. But I don't think that it's a matter of them being lazy. I think I see a lot more Pais on wine lists now than I ever did.
Glad
before.
To hear that. I think they're getting lazy and other stuff, but that's a different story.
Okay.
All right. We're going to move. Can we shut the lid on?
Sure.
All right. So that was great. Thank you for discussing and introducing our listeners to Chile and Itata. I think you're right. I think there's a lot of great wines and great values. So Itata, I-T-A-T-A from Chile, look out for that. We're going to move along to another interesting region. We're going to jump to Portugal. Portugal is known for their ports. They're known for their Douro Valley wines, their whites. But we're going to talk about an area, a region of Portugal called Alentejo. And Josh, when you look at the map of Portugal, where is Alentejo?
So it's directly east of Lisbon.
Okay.
And it's about one third of the country. And it's a very diverse region. We're really looking at wines from the north.
Okay.
This is about this wine grape that has found its home in Alentejo. Alicant Boucher. You get Alicant Boucher. It was developed in France as a cross. And you get it in a lot of the mixed blacks in California, the Zinfandel blends, old vines there. But it came to Portugal around 1870 or so. The French brought it there, and this family, the Reynolds family, which had been a cork producer. They had cork forests and made a lot of money in the cork business. They planted Alicant Boucher, and they were involved in Mouchau, which we have this wine here from Mouchau, which is their home estate. They also had a vineyard at Carmo, Quinta de Carmo, which was the king's palace that he'd bought for his courtesan, Donna Maria. And that wine was made actually as a, it was made as Quinta de Carmo in the 80s and became kind of legendary from, because it was from about 120-year-old vines. And Julio Bastos was the guy who was making it, because he was descended from John, he was related to John Reynolds and Isabel Bastos, who lived in this palace and farmed Alicant Boucher there. So there's the Bastos family that does a lot with Alicant Boucher. And they still have that particular, they still have that palace and they have vineyards around it. There's the Reynolds family at Mouchau that makes this beautiful wine. And then the Symington family, which is known as the biggest producer of, the biggest vineyard owner in port wine. This was their first project outside of the Douro. They bought a vineyard there called Quinta de Fonsoto.
When?
2017.
Okay, so it's fairy young.
Well, the vineyard was not young, but the project is young.
Yeah. Their foray into it started.
And I brought this set of wines because this is their first Alicant Boucher. And I think it's their best wine that they've produced out of this vineyard yet. And so this is from a very interesting region, actually. It's called Porto Alegre. It's in the hills. So the hills are basically up to around 2,000 feet where the vineyards are. Some go up to 2,300 feet. And then you get into the highest peak there is around 3,300 feet. But there are no vineyards that high. But it's these very beautiful, it's a very beautiful natural park where you have vineyards all up into the hills.
Wow.
And they have vineyards there that they've gotten very excited about. And they're very excited about this particular grape there. So I wanted to taste these two wines with you.
Okay.
Because they're very different expressions, but both very beautiful expressions of this grape.
Two questions. The first one is, in Alentejo, how many hectares, acres, whatever, are planted to Alicant Boucher? Is it a small amount, or it's starting to creep up?
I don't know the exact number. I got that number this morning. It's in my email, but I don't have it up in front of me.
Do you have a feel that it's not one of the major plantings, is it?
It's not one of the major plantings. I think that you would have much more Aragonese, much more Trincadera.
Right.
You have a lot of white grapes that are being grown, but it's mainly 70% of the vineyards are devoted to red grapes.
So that was the first question. Mm-hmm. The second question is, which wine should we taste first?
I think we should taste the Symington wine first.
Okay. Let's give it a pour. I'm going to stand up. Tell everyone a little about Symington.
So Charles Symington makes this wine with a group of people that he has on his team. And this is their project. They've been doing a lot of table wines in the Douro. And as a British family, some of the British families resisted table wine production. Some are getting into it heavily, like the Symingtons. And so they did a project with Bruno Prats in the Douro called Prats and Symington.
Prats is from France?
Prats is from France. Prats used to own Côte d'Estournel.
Right. Storied vineyard.
Yeah. And a very brilliant man. And he came and tried to figure out how to make a great red wine in the Douro Valley. So they learned a lot working with Bruno Prats about table wines, because they have a long, long history of port wines. This is their project on their own in a very different kind of region. There's good water here, as opposed to most other parts of good rain amounts here, as opposed to most other parts of the region of Alentejo, which is very dry and hot. Here you've got a mountain range, so you've got some Atlantic influence coming over from the mountain range in the north. And then you've also got some of that continental influence coming up from the south. So it's a very different kind of environment than they're used to. This grape is a red fruited grape, red pulp. So it produces a very different kind of wine than you'd get from a red skinned grape. And you have to manage it differently. And what they did with this wine is they did a post-fermentation maceration on it, which is a little counterintuitive because you might think that that would extract a lot of alcohol. When you have a lot of alcohol, it would extract a lot of tannins. They just all this alcohol in the wine after the fermentation, so it's going to pull a lot of the tannins out of the skins that are left. But in fact, I think it helped to integrate this wine because it's really beautifully integrated.
Now, before we taste it, Alicante Boucher, you mentioned to me off air, is a good varietal looking at climate change in front of you. Did you reference that?
People are experimenting with it in California, and they've got a lot of experience.
They've got
a lot of experience with Alicante Boucher in California from the 19th century.
Is the jury still out, or it seems
don't know that the jury's out on any of it. I think that
too soon.
The climate is going to change in ways that we can't predict.
Right.
And I think that once the ocean currents shift, all bets are off in terms of what climate will be where.
Right.
So we're used to, and that's what nobody's really talking about in terms of climate change, is how on the East Coast, the current that comes up the East Coast is getting weaker. The current going down the Atlantic and on the side of Europe is changing. The currents are going to change as the polar ice caps melt. The currents are going to change in terms of their strength and their direction, or could. So nobody really knows what's going to happen. And so is it the right grape? Who knows?
Right.
I think diversity is the key.
And experimentation, certainly. All right, so let's do a quick evaluation of this wine. It's a pretty deep, dark, brooding wine, right?
Yes, as opposed to the wine we had before,
yeah.
This is completely opaque in the glass. Yeah,
it's opaque. Let's go to the nose. Dark fruits. Yes?
I love the way this wine smells. Some people think that it's got a little bit of dried fruit, but I get this very bright cherry character to it, very lifted by the alcohol.
Yes.
But to me, the alcohol is beautifully integrated in this wine, and I don't experience heat on the wine.
There is no heat, and there is an alcohol element to the nose that works well. The mouthfeel is pretty big, right?
It's a big wine, but it's not harsh.
Mm-mm.
That's one of the things that I really love about this wine, is that it's so integrated, and so it's mouthwatering. You know, with a lot of wines of this scale, they're not mouthwatering, and this wine actually makes my mouth water.
When you say mouthwatering, does that point to being savory or not necessarily?
Savory and fresh.
Right. There is a freshness to it. There's a teeny bit of reductive quality to it.
Yeah. And I think this, you know, when you asked about whether Pais would be a wine to age, this is a wine to age.
Right.
I mean, these are, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to bring the Mouchau was because that's a young vintage of Mouchau. It's 2015. But I've had vintages of Mouchau that are 40 or 50 years old that are absolutely gorgeous. And these Alicante Boucher does, from this particular area of the world, it makes a great wine that ages. And it's counterintuitive because in France, you know, the French got involved in this area. They bought a part of Carmo from Julio Bastos. And they did a partnership with, he did a partnership with Domaine Lafitte Rothschild in the late 80s. And they came in and they thought, this variety in France is garbage. So it couldn't be interesting here in Portugal. We don't understand why it's interesting here in Portugal. And they convinced him in the end to pull out his 120-year-old vines.
Oh, boy.
And it's one of the great tragedies in Portugal.
I'd
because these were classic wines that he was making. And then they pulled out in the end in about 10 years later, or maybe a little longer actually than that. And then he ended up selling the project to Bacalhoa Group. So he no longer has the name Carmo, but he has his own vineyards, which are old, and he's got his own name, Donna Maria. But this is considered garbage in France. And in California, it was considered a good grape for prohibition because you could ship it easily. And it was a good home winemaker grape. But nowhere in the world that I know of makes Alacampouche at this level.
That's what I was going to say. This, so it has ageability, the quality is there. So the grape has an ability to age if made properly.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's proven, I mean, proven ability, yeah.
Yeah, you could see by, you know, the way it drinks and looks and all of that. All right, so that's an interesting project. We're going to move to the Moncheo. Is that how you pronounce it?
No, it's Muxiao.
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 The wire is in front of the U. Muxiao, M-O-U-C-H-A.
A with the tilde.
With the tilde, O. Now, is the are the Reynolds British?
Yes.
Okay. Certainly not.
And they still own, they've owned this property. They planted this property in the 1800s, and they still own the property.
All right, I'm going to pour this.
They actually lost the property to, during, right after the revolution in Portugal, there was a lot of communist activity in, you know, went from being a fascist country to much more communist, much more left-wing.
Right.
And there was a lot of communist activity in the Alentejo. And they took over a lot of the old haciendas, including Muxiao. And they didn't, their grapes, their really old vines did not survive that. But they have old vines still. They have some old vines still that are about, I think it's about 60 or 70 years old. And it's still the same property. So this is more central. It's not as far north as Fonsoto.
Yeah. The Symington. Mm-hmm. So a couple things. The Symington was a 2018. Mm-hmm. The Muxiao is a 2015. Mm-hmm. Are those a couple of back vintages or typically?
No, these are current releases.
Okay. So why are they current releases? They keep them in the bottle or barrel in both?
So the Muxiao is made in big vats, very large vats, and it's Portuguese oak, macacaúba and mahogany.
What's macacaúba?
It is a Brazilian wood that's a kind of a rare Brazilian wood.
Where they make vessels to store?
Yeah, they store these in those three. The varieties of wood used to make these big vats are those three varieties of wood. And so it's not in small barrel. And then they put it into bottle for a while. So it's been aged in vats for several years, and then in bottle for 7 years before it's released. They don't sell a lot of it, so it's not like, I mean, we had tasted the 2013 most recently, and now the 2015 is the current release.
Jeez.
And it also, it needs time. So this wine is a baby at, you know, at 8 years old, it's still a baby.
So 2013, it's in the market now, you open it. When would be a good window for this? Wait another 3-4 years?
I opened a bottle of their 87 Dom Raphael, which is their second wine and considered the secondary production. I opened that about 5 years ago and it was in prime condition.
Really?
So that would have been what? Probably a 30-year-old wine. Is that right?
Or a little under.
Yeah.
27, 20. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right there.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And that's their second wine. So these wines live to be 40, 50 years old, no problem.
All right, so let's taste this, and we'll talk about it more. Again, the color,
you know, really dark,
deep purple, dark, brooding. On the nose,
this one's a little more floral to me.
A little more floral, a little more bright, little less red. Of that alcohol, but not stating that in a negative way. It's just not an aspect of this nose.
And this also has some Trincadera in it. So I think that's what's driving some of the floral aspects of it, and that
what
red and the red
fruit. Do you think?
I think it's about 15%.
Okay.
Not much, but I think it's about 15%.
All right, let's give it. Let's throw it over the tongue. This seems the profiles of the alcohol and the tannins seem smoother or lighter on this. I never get those descriptors right. What would you say?
I find the tannin grippier and a little harder, actually.
Do you?
Yeah. I find the tannin more integrated in the
Fonsuto. To me, more integrated. But integrated here, to me before grippier.
Okay.
But I'm not arguing with you. Mm-hmm.
No, I prefer the tannic expression in the Mushao. I think it's more detailed. But I definitely get more presence of tannin in it. They're less smooth. For me, they're less smooth. They're more detailed and they're more, I don't find them aggressive.
No.
But I find them harder edged and
but in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. Not in a bad way at all.
And then the palate. What do you pick up on the palate? And then I want to talk about the difference between this and the Symington. The palate on this wine.
I think it's shut down. I mean, for me, and it's been open, this wine has been open for a day, and I think it's still shut down. I mean, to me.
Was it shut down when you initially tasted it?
Yep.
Okay.
And I get more upfront on this wine, and then to me, it goes into the tannins, and I get the flavor of the tannins more than the flavor of the fruit. So I get the scent of the fruit on it, but I don't get as much. I get some red fruit on the palate, but not at the level that I think I will 10 years from now or 20 years from now.
Interesting. The mouthfeel is, you know, it's a nice full mouthfeel, medium plus. Now, between the two wines, is one more distinctive than the other for the things we just discussed or other things?
Well, I think that one is more approachable than the other. I would say that the Symington wine is more approachable and is a wine that I would more happily drink right now than the Mushao wine, which I think is very, very young and harder and has more. I don't get the mouthwatering quality on the Mushao that I think I will when it's 20 years old.
Not to ask for you to pick your favorite kid, but when both of these wines are flying, mm-hmm. they have their own traits. Mm-hmm. Is one a better wine than the other, or that's not even the right question?
I don't know how I would say that one is better than the other. They're very different wines. And I think
that's what I want to hear.
I think that it's fascinating that this variety, it's not so far apart. I mean, one is in the hills, one is on the plain, you know, or on rolling hills. The Mushao is on more alluvial soils and red loam. And the Symington wine, Fonsuto, is going to be in that, I think it's more, I don't want to say because I'm not sure exactly what the soil is there. But it's a very different, probably rockier soil. I know that other parts of Portalegre are very, very rocky. And it's a completely different expression. You know, it's high, that's a higher altitude wine, so you get that freshness.
It's actually a silly question comparing the two.
But I think it's interesting to compare the two because they're because they are so different.
I didn't mean comparing. I mean, is one better than the other? I think comparing is great in that sense. As far as Alentejo climate change effects, I mean, it's a hot region. Are they, you know, confronted with any challenges? Have they haven't seen fires like Europe, Napa, or Chile even?
Well, a lot of Portugal has been on fire for several vintages.
Yeah.
So they've had really terrible fires in Portugal. I don't know if Alentejo has had as much fire as some of the other regions. But the fact that it's always been a very hot, dry region is going in its favor because the vines are accustomed to that. They also, in 2002, I think it was, completed this vast dam project. So it's the biggest dam in the south. It's the biggest dam in Western Europe and the biggest handmade lake in Western Europe, Alcaiva.
In Alentejo?
In Alentejo, yeah.
I think we were at a high point, and, you know, it's not hard to miss.
Mm-hmm. If you were down by, like, Regengos to Montserrat, that area is right by the lake.
Okay.
And, you know, in the central, I think that's probably where you were when you were at that hacienda.
Yeah.
In that area.
I think so.
But so that gives them lots of water if they need to irrigate.
Lucky for them. When we were talking about Chile, you know, it's been tough to get some of the wines into mm-hmm. the States for various reasons, which we discussed. Is Alentejo going to fall prey to those same problems, or they've been here a little longer and they're coming in easier? Because the wines are wonderful and we want people to drink them.
I think it depends on the wine itself, the specific product, and it depends on the welcoming of the market for a small artisan producer. So we tried to get a wine that I wanted to show some people, this wine called Estremus, which is grown in rocky marble right outside of Estremos, outside the Estremos wall. And we couldn't, it's not in this country. And it's the best wine that João Portugal Ramos makes. He makes a lot of different wines. A lot of his wines are in the country. That one is not. Muxau was not in the country on and off for a long time. Now it's in the country. It just moved to a new distributor. And so it may get more focus and attention. The Symingtons have their own importer.
You know, they have they self-import. Sway, so they cloud, have, exactly. Connections.
Yeah. But
Good too, because
oh, absolutely. If they're making good wine,
The region, you know, they'll help promote that.
No question.
And like you said, they're making good wine, which is, you know, obviously why you selected as one of them.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
All right, so let me just recap. We tasted the 2015 Muxau from Alentejo, Alicante Boucher, and we tasted the Symington Quinta da Fonte Souto Alicante Boucher. That is a 2018, and Josh mentioned that these are basically the current vintages, so there are some very interesting wines. It's nice to talk about Portugal with you and to delve into not a new region, but a region that deserves, you know, some nice attention. All right, we're going to move along to our fourth wine. We're coming to the United States. We are going to taste the 2019 Heiress. It's got a long name. California Centennial Mountain Vineyard Brico Rosso. Wine and Spirits gave it a 93. It's a $60 wine, so not off the charts, but not, you know, a cheap wine. Josh, you selected this for a lot of reasons, but let me just give you the setup. Heiress is a project of the Rhys people, R-H-Y-S, who make incredible Pinots and Chards.
And they're based in Santa Cruz Mountains.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the great winemakers in that region, not tons of them. And here's where I want you to take the ball and run. I mean, this is Nebbiolo.
Well, this is a blend of varieties, actually.
Right, but there's Nebbiolo in here.
I think there's, let me see what's in this. It's four varieties, and it is,
This is not the Nebbiolo one?
No. So I brought the other wine.
You didn't bring the Brico Rosso?
No, they sent Centenari. Okay,
all right,
interesting.
So you have to admit one thing. I'm not crazy.
Oh, okay.
All right, so let's... So one of the things we discussed was...
I pulled the wrong wine,
We were going to do a Brico Rosso, which was an interesting Nebbiolo project in California, you know, with the Heiress Rhys people. Let's put that aside. Now let's move forward.
So this is their project.
Okay.
But this is their project in Etna Rosso. So this is their project in Etna. So basically, they had planted... I wanted to show you the Nerello Mascalese wine that they were making in Sonoma. But I think that they must have sent me a bottle of this that I didn't see that it was a different bottle until now.
And Josh, so this is their centenary. I don't know if you're getting old or you're distracted.
I'm distracted. I'm old. I'm old and I'm distracted.
Can I tell you an interesting thing? I've been on the Reese mailing list 20 years, you know, and they have all kinds of projects. So when Heiress came out, I think the first wines they offered were Netna Rosso, you know, and then they started doing Sonoma projects and all that. So they've been at this for a few years as far as I could see.
Yeah, they're working with Silvia Foti, in who's based in Etna. But let me pour this for you.
All right, so to set up this wine. So once again, read off the bottle exactly, you know, what it is. Ooh, that's interesting.
So this is their Centenari. It's an Etna Rosso from Sicily 2019. And it is 100-year-old Nerello Moscalese, and it's growing in the in their Monte LaGuardia estate on the northern slope of Sicily's Mount Etna.
So, is it all Nerello Moscalese?
This is 100% Nerello Moscalese.
And it's older vines, obviously.
100-year-old vines, yeah.
All right, so just quickly talk about Sicily in the sense of the varietal in this wine.
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to bring the Sonoma County wine is that it was really interesting to me that they are planting Nerello Moscalese in Sonoma, and as well as Nebbiolo, but I'm more interested in the fact that they're planting Nerello Moscalese because I think it's an it's a fascinating climate change question. You know, is this kind of, is this wine, is this particular grape suitable for the climate and the coming climate in Sonoma if you have a very high elevation vineyard in the hills of Sonoma County?
Is Sonoma cooler than Napa?
Parts of it are.
Okay.
You know, Napa is cool in places and hot in other places.
Right.
You know,
so that's,
yeah. So
same
if you have
Sonoma.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because how would you describe the climate in Sicily, in Etna?
I would describe it as, well, I mean, the northern slope is going to be cooler than the southern slope. But I would describe it as an arid, I don't know enough about, Etna is not my region.
Right.
But my impression is that it's arid and hot.
And volcanic soils.
Yeah, volcanic soils.
You know,
yeah.
Famous for being a volcanic area and all that. All right. So this is a project by a wonderful winery.
Jeff Brinkman makes the wine in California. I imagine.
Is Jeff Brinkman the Reese winemaker?
Yes. Or,
okay. Yeah. So he's doing the Heiress project.
Yep. And I imagine that Foti makes the wine. Foti makes this wine.
I'm sure Brinkman gets on a plane and plays around with them a little every now and then. All right, so let's talk about this wine. Nice purple, a little more translucent, but, you know, nice, pretty deep translucent purple.
I think this is more delicate than the California wine I was going to bring, which is richer.
I would guess.
Yep.
I would guess. It's, you know, it's almost like one of the richer Pinot Noir colors. How about on the nose? Different nose than anything we've tasted.
Very mushroomy to me.
Is it earthy and mushroomy to you? Any fruit?
And a lot of
there?
Dark fruit. A lot of dark fruit. More like, it's not to prune, but it's very ripe and dark.
On the palate, it's ripe. Yep. The mouthfeel is a medium mouthfeel.
Yeah, medium to light.
You know what I love? I suck at descriptors. And when you say mushroomy and then you spend a few seconds, it's mushroomy.
Yeah, and it's so suggestive.
You know, I sit there and I go, this is different. What is that? And mushrooms not running through my head. But
it's really suggestive. And I think that part of it is like, if you can suggest something that's close, then other people might say, oh yeah, I see that. But you can also suggest things that are, I mean, I often suggest things that are far off base for other people. And
but
they just
also
say, I don't
so
get that.
General, like mineral or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, mushroomy is a little more, you know, in the zone as far as the description and all that. All right, what about on the palate? There's a savory quality to it.
It's definitely savory. And volcanic wines definitely have a textural aspect to the tannins that's different from most other wines.
Explain that. Explain what that means and why. Is it the volcanic soil? Is it the climate?
I'm sure the climate has something to do with it. I think that the soil, volcanic soils would probably feed the vines in a certain way that other soils don't. So you're getting certain nutrients and not other nutrients in a volcanic soil. And I don't know enough about plant physiology to be able to say why volcanic soils would give me this impression of a very dry tannin, a very austere tannin. But I tend to get that if I taste a Canary Islands wine.
Right.
If I taste an Etna wine, I like that austerity.
Yeah.
To me, it's a particular kind of structural aspect that I associate with volcanic wines, especially volcanic island wines.
So one of the interesting things about this wine is that, like I said earlier, it's a cool winemaker, Rhys, that mm-hmm. started a project and really literally went out of their regional zone. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say comfort zone.
No, their comfort zone, definitely. Yeah.
Probably.
I mean, they started it for Nebbiolo, and then they ended up looking at Nerello at Mascalese as well.
So are they doing anything in the Piedmont area with Nebbiolo as they're doing in Etna?
I think that they are.
Okay.
I mean, they have a winemaker. They're working with a winemaker from Piedmont. Let me just check to see who that is. So I'm pretty sure they're working with a winemaker from Piedmont as well.
Josh, do we know the approximate retail?
Gianpiero Romana from Piedmont to plant Nebbiolo.
Okay. Yeah.
So do we know I don't know because I didn't intend to bring this particular wine.
Threw us a ringer. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's the Aris, Nero Mascalese. Etna, what's the vintage year, Josh?
2019.
All right. Anything else we want to say on that?
I think it's more delicate than most of the Nerello Mascalese that I tend to taste. I think it's rather beautiful, but it's a very delicate wine. Yeah.
What about this argument? There are so many good producers in Sicily and mm-hmm. Etna. Why should I drink this?
It's a good question. I think it's a beautiful
bunch of
wine.
California guys that.
Well, this is. I mean, Foti is not Californian. He's
right.
from Etna.
So that's part one of the answer. Mm-hmm. They went over there with a guy who knows the area.
I think that if you are, first of all, you've got very old vines. So and you've got other Americans working over there, Marco de Grazia. You know, you got people working over there.
Been there for years.
Mom. Yeah.
I think all the boxes are checked. The varietal, mm-hmm. The vineyards, 100-year-old vines, the winemaker. I think Aris and Rhys sort of have great chops.
Absolutely.
You know,
and I also think that if you are tasting their wine that I was intending to bring, their blend, their Brico Rosso, that this would be an interesting corollary to it.
Right.
Which is probably why they sent it to me. They're probably the other bottle, the Brico Rosso bottle is probably in my office still sitting in the box that they sent.
Well, here's what I want you to do. When are you coming back from Vienna?
On the 13th.
All right. When you come back, I want you to, if you can taste that wine and just give me a paragraph mm-hmm. between the two wines, because mm-hmm. I think in our postings we'll mention that.
Okay.
It would be interesting because your mind was set on that. We did this. Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting, you know,
sure.
change and mm-hmm. all that. Let's see what happens. All right. So those are our four wines. A few things. I will post all the wines that we tasted down to the specifics.
And I hope you'll drink them later on because they're all four of these are going to get better by tonight or
no
tomorrow.
No kidding.
Yeah.
All right. So I will post the wines. Josh selected those wines for 2023 because those were significant to him. I just wanted to ask you a few more questions. I know you spent a decent amount of time in Austria mm-hmm. tasting and talking about Blaufränkisch.
I'm
surprised that didn't come up in this mix.
I thought about bringing it, but that was last year that I was there. That was in December of last year.
That was the end of last year.
I think that the I was just about to leave for that trip.
That was after we talked.
Exactly.
But there's been some good tailwinds on Blaufränkisch, right? I mean, it's definitely something to pay attention to.
I think that for me, it is expressing a Central European gestalt or like mindset or way of, it expresses a Central European character that we don't necessarily think about with red wine. We think about Central Europe for white wine, for Riesling, and for Grüner Veltliner. But it has a depth of, it has a soulful depth that is, I find absolutely fascinating.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, when you Gut Ogau and Wassenhaus and all these producers making these, I was at a Blaufränkisch masterclass less than a month ago, and we must have tasted 40 wines. I mean, the diversity, the regions was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, we had a wine from Dorley-Muir last weekend from Carnuntum. Most of the Blaufränkisch is from Burgenland, which is the area just east of Vienna and east and south.
By that lake, right?
Well, it's all along the border of Hungary. And then Carnuntum is along the Danube to the north. And just, it's basically east of Vienna, north of Burgenland. And her Reed Spitzerberg, beautiful wines from Reed Spitzerberg. And some of the wines from Lautzmannberg and from further south that Wachtler Wiesler is making, or they're insanely great wines, and they're again undervalued for what they are.
I agree with that. So staying on that topic, when we look at 2024, what's on your schedule? What's on your plans? Do you have trips? Like we said, you were in Austria this time last year, a couple of weeks later. Are there places you're going that are scheduled? Are the places you want to be going back to check back new places?
I'm definitely headed to Austria today.
Okay. So, we know that.
And I'm exploring old vines in Wachau and Kamtal. And how they are surviving through climate change. So that's my research project for this week. After that, I really want to get back to Champagne. I need to get back to Bordeaux. I need to get back to Portugal again. I was there in September, but I want to go to some other regions again. I want to get back to Chile again. So there's lots of places I need to get back to.
Let me fixate on Champagne and Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. When was the last time you were in Champagne?
Oof, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Okay. Yeah. And when you go there now, are there things that you're looking for? Are there producers regions? Everything is really...
Yeah, I would go with a specific project in mind, and I think I would probably go to the Aube.
Okay.
Because I have not been to the Aube.
The Aube, and talk to winemakers there. Now, Bordeaux has been such an up and down story. I mean, you know, legendary before Burgundy, Burgundy's hot. Bordeaux, huge, great value. What's the story or your interest in Bordeaux?
Well, I don't really want to talk about the story that I'm doing, but There is a story there about, it's the same kind of story that is going on in Napa Valley, that people talk about bringing in all these new varieties. And some of the varieties that are there and, you know, extant there are actually performing well through climate change. So people don't think that Merlot has a lot of chops for climate change, and it might, in fact, perform very well in climate change. So, and the same thing at Cabernet Sauvignon, when people talk about replanting Napa Valley with other grapes, there's a story in our current issue that Steve Mathiasen is quoted as saying, well, you know, Napa Valley is very different from north to south, and there are parts of Napa Valley that are still too cool for Cabernet Sauvignon. So
that's interesting.
And you can plant the vines, you can tend the vines, you can create a different direction for the rows, and you can create different trellising systems to prevent too much
That's heat. Interesting. Yeah. That's the discussion now out of necessity. Like, is Coombsville cooler?
Very cool.
And is Carneros cooler?
Yeah, Carneros is, I mean, you don't see a lot of Cabernet.
Not known for red wines.
Yeah.
Right.
But so you see some great Cabernets in Carneros, and you see some great Cabernets in Coombsville.
I know I had Paul Hobbs on. He makes, you know, a lot of wines in Coombsville. All right. So we'll look forward to that. I can't let you leave without doing our wine list. This will be the seventh one. At some point, I have to compare.
Okay.
Five questions, same five questions I asked you the six previous times, same five questions I've asked my other 265 other show guests. Don't dwell on them. Let's go quick. What are you drinking now? What are you drinking personally? You know, what are you curious about at home? Do the seasons change? What's in your fridge? What are you forced to drink for work?
What am I drinking now is Pais.
Pais.
Yep.
Okay.
And Senso.
And for every reason that we discussed. About.
Yep.
It's delicious.
Honestly, it's what I'm drinking.
You said you want to buy cases to have them. Okay.
No, I'm going to. Yeah.
So Pais and Senso. All right. Favorite wine and food pairing? Dumbest question on the list. Can't take it off. I wonder if it's the same. It's not what you think is good. It's what you like. Like what works every time. And you don't eat it every week, every, you know, month.
That's a really tough question to answer.
I have to look at your past answers.
Well, I would think about the duck that my friend roasted for Chef Amy Lovelace. She roasted a couple ducks for Thanksgiving.
Is Amy the restaurant owner? No.
No.
Who's the woman who moved from the Upper East Side to Tribeca?
Oh, no, that's Tina Vaughn.
Tina. Okay. Yeah. So Amy made duck.
Mm-hmm. And I think of the Blaufränkisch that we had with the duck that was really beautiful.
There's an updated contemporary wine and food. So duck and Blaufränkisch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why does that work? Duck is a little darker, fattier.
Mm-hmm.
Blaufränkisch works with that. Why?
I think that, I think that you could do a lot of different wines with duck that have good acidity, have good freshness, and are... the acidity will cut through the fattiness of the duck. You know, we had a Geyserville from Ridge with it that was delicious.
Works.
Perfect. So, yeah.
All right. Third question. Don't forget I've asked you these questions before. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar?
Well, there I would go with Eulalie, which is Tina Vaughn's new place.
Right.
Yeah.
And I ask you this not to leave people out or rate them. Like Josh, you know, you... run a magazine. Mm-hmm. Why are you picking places? That's not, it's about who does it right.
I mentioned Tina because you don't even need to look at her wine list. She'll just choose wines for you that she has worked with the food that her husband Chip produces. And her sensibility around wine and food pairing is astonishing.
How long has she been down in Tribeca?
Not long. I think they opened this fall.
Oh, so pretty recently. Mm-hmm. I was going to say 6-7 months. But no, they were
doing kind of construction over the summer, and I went there for a construction dinner over the summer. But then I've been there in the fall since they've been open,
nice.
And it's very beautiful.
I was at a La Macchioli tasting with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
was sitting next to her, and she was getting things going then. All right, fourth question. Favorite all-time wine question originally, and you were subject to this because this is your seventh show. When I asked you the question initially, I'm like, Josh, you're like the editor, publisher of a wine magazine. You've had access to what's the most expensive rare wine you ever tasted? That's not the question anymore. The question is, and now it's more interesting to comparison to your last few years, what's the wine that influenced you, that was a gateway, that was transcendent, that was memorable? You know, it didn't have to be rare or expensive. It just had to be important.
Probably the wine, I would say one of the wines that influenced me the most is that Chambo Musigny from the 80s. From Roumier, yeah. I think that when I think about wines that I covet his Village wine from Chambo Musigny. I covet a lot of wines.
Because he's a great winemaker. It's gotten expensive, but it's still...
Because he's a great grower. He's a farmer, and he's a really brilliant farmer, and he's a very intuitive farmer, and he grew up that way, and he always has been. And he, you know, now it's kind of ridiculous to say, but I think that he is, he brought his family's wines to a level that's astonishing, you know, that people now are
for sure
paying fortunes for those wines.
Sadly.
Yeah.
You know, Roumier is at the top of the discussion in the mm-hmm. mix of, you know, the best wines in Burgundy. All right, last question. Nobody better than you to answer this. You've devoted your life to sort of solving these type of questions. The question is, best wine around 15, 20, 22 bucks, a red and a white. I always said you can go category, like Muscadet is a pretty good value for white if you get the right producer. Where do you see that? I'm going to guess in the past you've said Portugal, you know.
Well, for white wine, I mean, I just drink Vigne Verde. I love Vigne Verde.
So Vigne Verde
is getting better and better. Yeah.
So that's our white wine. Yeah. Is there a producer or two that?
There are plenty.
Okay. Yeah,
but I mean, there's so much good
Vigne category.
Verde. Yeah. It's and it's really hard to go bad. You can buy really cheap wines. You can buy $25 wines. Soliero, to me, is the benchmark wine.
Which one?
Soliero.
Spell.
S-O-A-L-H-E-R-O. Soliero.
Yeah. Wow. I would have had to Google that like 90 times if I didn't ask you.
The Sidera family has this vineyard, and they're just doing astonishing things there now. I was there in September, and Luis is brilliant. And he's got a really great team.
So that's why I ask these questions, because that recommendation from you is an important one to a lot.
Yeah, but there's Anselmo Mendes who makes amazing wines.
No, I disclaimed it by saying it's not number one. It's not mm-hmm. the only. It's just a suggestion mm-hmm. that's on your radar, mm-hmm. you know, fairly. How about a red?
Well, as I say, the reds I'm drinking are Pais and Senso from Itata.
So I'm honor record. That answer.
I'm a broken record, sorry.
Because Isabel Legero gave me the same answer for mm-hmm. red wines, that you should go to Chile and Male mm-hmm. and Pais and all of that. So we'll take that. All right, Josh, I thank you for our seventh year. This is kind of special. Not a lot of people could say, you know, they get together and have this discussion this many times. So I appreciate you doing this. I appreciated it from day one. I appreciate that you still do it. I appreciate your selection to the wines. So thank you for that. Let me do a quick wrap up. I'll get some info from you and then we're out of here. Josh is on his way to Vienna. I'm on my way to Jersey. Who's got the better trip? All right. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your pods. Leave a review if you like the podcast. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and on Twitter at BenRuby. I know they're different, but you can always find us on both if you use the hashtag The Grape Nation. We're on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we will post Josh's wine list answers, which we just did. And as I mentioned earlier, we will post the wines that we tasted, because these were interesting, curated, meaningful wines for discussion and tasting. Josh, a couple things. If we want to find out more information or access Wine and Spirits magazine, maybe subscribe or go there for information, where do we go?
You go to wineandspiritsmagazine.com, or you can come to our event in New York on February 15th at the Metropolitan Pavilion, where we will be pouring our top 100 wineries of the year. So that's coming up in February.
God, I didn't realize. You know what? I haven't seen much social media on that.
It's just we're just announcing it
okay.
now. Yeah.
All right. So I've been to a bunch of those, and this is a wine tasting, a walk around wine tasting of the most highly curated wines. This is literally Josh and his people, after tasting thousands and thousands of wines, inviting winemakers for whatever reason, and we're not going to get into that, come to our tasting in February and please pour your wine. So it's very special. Are you still doing it in San Francisco too?
We did it in San Francisco in October.
Okay.
So it was a beautiful event in San Francisco, and then we're doing it in New York in February.
All right. So do you have the exact date?
February 15th?
February 15th, Wine and Spirits. When you look at it, it's and is spelled out, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's spirit. Wine is singular and spirits is plural and magazine is all spelled out.
Okay. And social media, Wine and Spirits. I think it's just at Wine and Spirits, yep. Mm-hmm. Twitter and Instagram. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Are you posting with any regularity there?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So Susanna Smith manages our social media and she is posting a lot.
You know, if you've been around long enough, Josh and I used to fight about this. I would say, Josh, you need to get your social media game up a little more. And he was like, oh, okay, yeah, yeah. But this is 5-7 years ago. Now you're there. Good for you. You got somebody there. All right. I want to thank my guest, Josh Green. I've thrown all the praise at him already and thankful to call him a friend and thankful that he comes here every year. I want to thank our engineer Armin and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.